welcome to the reading of the Cedar Falls Waterloo Courier for Thursday, June 23rd, 2022. I'm your reader, Mary Frances. The front page of the Courier today, big story, Grassley, colon, gun bill, quote, vague. Then we have the second story, it's got a photo of local stage actor and director Joe Frenna testing dry ice as an effect for a scene in his movie directorial debut, Hot Spots in Waverly, which he'll begin shooting on Saturday. And the headline on that one is Film Hits the Hot Spots. Another story on the front page, Church Copper Theft Leads to Arrest. And the fourth story, Pledge Could Kick Off Meeting. So we'll click in with the first story, top of the fold. Grassley says, vague language defining dating relationship, his concern in bipartisan gun bill. And then it has a photo of Senator Grassley visiting with constituents June 3rd at the Lincoln Savings Bank in Waterloo. Story comes from Maria Kuiper of The Courier, and she writes, Iowa's two Republican senators split on Tuesday in their votes on whether to advance a measure aimed at keeping guns away from dangerous people in the wake of several mass shootings. The legislation, negotiated for 2 weeks by a bipartisan group of senators, was released Tuesday afternoon ahead of a procedural vote. It cleared the Senate 64-34. U.S. Republican Senator Chuck Grassley voted against the legislation, and fellow Iowa Republican Joni Ernst, joining 13 other GOP senators in voting yes to advance it, passed the 60-vote hurdle. The vote is an initial test of support for the bill, which is expected to come up for a final vote later this week. On a call with reporters Wednesday, Grassley said he voted against advancing the legislation because he received the 80-page bill called the Bipartisan Safer Communities Act in too short of time ahead of the vote to review the text of the legislation, which he said he and his staff are doing now. Quote, almost all of it is good, but I have some concerns that I will be wrestling with to decide a yes or no vote, and they deal with safeguarding constitutional due process, Grassley said. Among other measures, the bill bans convicted domestic abusers, including those in serious dating relationships, from purchasing a gun for at least 5 years, stepping toward closing a so-called boyfriend loophole. Grassley said he thought the definition of a dating relationship in the bill was too vague. The bill defines dating relationship as, quote, a relationship between two individuals who have or have recently had a continuing serious relationship of a romantic or intimate nature, unquote. The bill also clarifies that, quote, a casual acquaintanceship or ordinary fraternization in a business or social context does not constitute a dating relationship. Quote, I'm trying to get the best legal advice on it, but so far it seems to me the text is pretty vague to be enforced in the definition of what a dating relationship is, Grassley said. And the quote continues, and then in regard to due process, respondents in courts won't be able to determine who is subject to law since those definitions are vague, and I think that needs to be clarified, unquote. Among other features of the proposal, it would make juvenile and mental health records available during background checks when someone under the age of 21 buys a gun. It also funnels federal funds to states enacting red flag laws, which aim to temporarily confiscate guns from people considered to be dangerous. It puts millions of dollars toward expanding mental health programs in communities and schools and bolstering school safety as well. In addition, the bill hardens penalties for so-called straw purchasing when individuals buy guns for people barred from purchasing firearms. Ernst's support for advancing the bill centers on it preserving the rights. I'm sorry, that was a misspelling. Ernst's support for advancing the bill centers on it preserving the rights of law-abiding Americans. Quote, as a lifelong supporter of the Second Amendment, proud gun owner and combat vet, I'm adamantly opposed to any infringement on our constitutional rights. This bill does not take away the rights of any law-abiding American, Ernst said in a statement emailed to the Quad City Times. Every American, the quote continues, wants to keep our kids and our schools safe and provide folks access to mental health treatment. And this proposal helps do that without placing new restrictions on law-abiding gun owners. Ernst has previously objected to similar language, opposing a proposal that would have retroactively classified assault convictions as felonies and banned those convicted from owning or purchasing guns. Next story, Pledge of Allegiance could be recited at Cedar Falls Council meetings. This is from Andy Malone of the Courier. The City Council appears to be on board with giving meeting attendees the opportunity to recite the Pledge of Allegiance. Quote, ever since I started on council, I've always felt it was missing when I started the meeting, said Mayor Rob Green to councilors Monday night. No public objections to the proposed change were raised by any of the seven elected members while meeting in committee Monday to discuss a package of procedural changes. All revisions and additions to policy will come back to committee again at a later date to formalize what was discussed on Monday. A final vote of approval would have to happen at a regular business meeting. The discussion came about as a result of a council discussion and consensus earlier this month. Green, with the assistance of City Attorney Kevin Rogers, formalized in a memo 33 proposed revisions, some of which were previously brought up by the elected officials during past conversations. The mayor labeled some in the collection as simple. Additionally, others were more detailed or political in nature. A final classification was given regarding ones that impacted, quote, the balance of power. Quote, the Pledge of Allegiance is an important American civic custom, which helps to provide a common sense of purpose and unity at the start of civic meetings across the country. All other area city councils, that's Waterloo, Waverly, and Hudson, as well as the Black Hawk County Board of Supervisors, begin their meetings with the pledge, and I strongly believe that the Cedar Falls City Council should be doing the same, said Green in a memo to the council. At least two councilors had minor concerns with the phrase "One Nation Under God" in the pledge, because not everyone is Christian and the meeting is intended to be a neutral setting. A few said they preferred it be recited as currently written. Either way, participation would be voluntary. Quote, the separation of church and state. The cases say that this is a historical custom. It sort of pushes off the church and state problem, Rogers said. Making it mandatory is a problem, he added. After the meeting, Green said he did not know if the pledge had ever been recited at council meetings, and he did not have an answer as to why it had not been part of the itinerary. Councilors discussed a number of other recommendations the same evening. One was adding a second public comment period near the end of the meeting for comments or questions related to items that were passed or not passed, in addition to the first one that's already offered at the beginning. Consensus by the council was that that wasn't necessary, largely due to there almost always being time before votes on significant business for the public to offer a comment. The council reached consensus on changing or keeping certain meeting guidelines, and now there's a bulleted list that I'll read. Remote attendance of council meetings, either by Zoom, if staff is notified by noon on Friday, ahead of the Monday meeting, or by telephone, will be allowed. It is preferred that cameras be turned on if using Zoom. Next bullet, the city administrator and directors would give staff updates toward the beginning of the meetings as opposed to the end of the meetings. Next, city councilors' proposed referrals of topics or questions to be researched by staff and brought back to committee for consideration would be presented in writing before meetings so that they could be included in the council's packet. Exceptions may be allowed. Next bullet, the meeting chair has discretion on whether to read aloud the titles of the consent and resolution calendar prior to votes. Instead, the chair could decide to just read the number associated with each one. Next, the meeting chair will be given discretion over a time limit for those making public comment, but it can be overruled by disagreeing members. And next, the next person in line to lead a council meeting, if both the mayor and the mayor pro tem are absent, would be, quote, the most senior member, unquote, as opposed to the originally proposed chair of the administration committee. In our next story from the front page, contractor arrested for allegedly stealing copper from historic church. Dateline Waterloo. This is from Jeff Reinitz of the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier. A contractor has been arrested for allegedly damaging and stealing from an historic Waterloo church that he was hired to repair. Police arrested Anthony Joseph Tucker, age 35, of Waterloo on Tuesday, on a warrant for second-degree theft and first-degree criminal mischief. He was released pending trial. Tucker had been contracted to renovate a back entrance and undertake other projects at the Mount Moriah Missionary Baptist Church, located at 633 Walnut. Instead, he stripped copper molding and fixtures from the 111-year-old church, including the copper ring encircling the base of its iconic octagonal dome, and he sold it as scrap metal, according to court records. Damages to the neoclassical revival style building are likely to exceed $10,000, records state. Quote, it's sad. That's historical material, said Reverend Corey Holmes, a former Atlanta area police officer who now serves as Mount Moriah's pastor. Holmes said he hired Tucker's company after hearing good reviews from other churches he had worked on, but he did not agree with some of the recommendations Tucker came up with for Mount Moriah. Tucker had suggested selling off the building's stained glass windows, saying the church could make some good money and replace them with lower-cost modern windows, Holmes said. The pastor said Tucker had also suggested replacing copper fittings on the exterior, gutters, and downspouts that had developed a green patina, and selling the old material for the value of that metal. Holmes said he had turned down the ideas. This is a historic building. We can't do that, he said. Tucker continued to work on the church, and at one point, the pastor snapped a photo of Tucker and another man working on the roof. Then a week later, Holmes suspected something was different when he pulled into the church's back lot. Holmes pulled up a photo he had taken and used it like a spot-the-difference puzzle. I knew the copper was missing, Holmes said. During a subsequent search through the building, Holmes noted two copper panels had been removed from inside and copper pipes had been cut from the boiler room. Also, old desks had been rummaged through. Holmes, his law enforcement background kicking in, called Tucker, who denied any knowledge of the missing items, Holmes said. The pastor called around to local scrapyards and notified police, who found out that Tucker had been selling copper molding to the Alter Metal Recycling Company. Court records indicate that Tucker had turned in 608 pounds of metal in May and June and received $2,006 for it. The recycling company had not processed the last pallet of metal they received from Tucker, but Holmes said there isn't much they can do with it. It has been hammered down and cannot be reinstalled. And replacing the lost copper fixtures with new copper fixtures is not possible, he said. Instead, the church will have to use substitute materials for the repairs. The church is now at a standstill with its renovation project, and Holmes said construction permits were never taken out, so the city issued a stop work order. Originally built in 1911 as Grace Methodist Episcopal Church, the building was placed on the National Register of Historic Places in 2011 because of its high level of historic integrity. The application even noted the copper gutters. In 2017, Preservation Iowa listed the church as one of the organization's most endangered historical buildings. And moving inside the paper to the Cedar Valley section, airport parking project planned. Canopies, lighting, just among facility updates. Dateline Waterloo, this is from Maria Kuiper. Passengers at the Waterloo Regional Airport will see some changes after the City Council Monday approved the go-ahead for two projects. In the parking lot, a nearly $2.2 million project will add coverings for cars and passengers. The money comes from the Iowa Coronavirus State and Local Fiscal Recovery Funds, which was part of the American Rescue Plan. The project will add covered canopies with LED lighting at the entrance and exit of the parking lot, as well as over 60 parking spots, including handicap spots. The entrance canopy structure is expected to cost $205,000, and the exit canopy is expected to cost $503,750. The covered parking structures are estimated to cost about $1.1 million. Another part of the project includes the rehabilitation of the passenger parking lot asphalt pavement. The project will use $200,000 of Federal Aviation Administration-approved land release funds. The projects will happen in phases so that the parking lot can remain in use. The funds are available for airports to use in either terminal construction or renovation, hangar structure construction, or parking structures. The council also approved preliminary plans and set a date for bids for the continuation of the airport's rehabilitation to its aircraft hangar storage facility. The project will include an interior renovation of office spaces as well as replacement of outdated fixtures and appliances. That work is expected to take 270 days or about 9 months. Airport Director Keith Kaspari said he hopes the project will lead to office suites being leased out, which would increase revenue for the airport. There will be a public hearing on the renovation July 18, 5:30 p.m. in the City Council Chambers. Coming to the airport later this month is an advanced security scanner that will feature 3D imaging. The new technology will provide explosives detection and is supposed to help the Transportation Security Administration better detect possible threats in carry-ons. Quote, "I am pleased that officials selected the Waterloo Regional Airport for this improvement," said Kaspari. And the quote continues, "This upgauge of equipment at the passenger security checkpoint continues the plan for DHS and Transportation Security Administration officials for additional improvement to the ALO Waterloo's security technology," unquote. The TSA is installing the scanner Monday, and it should be operational by the end of Thursday. Kaspari is asking passengers to allow for additional time to pass through the checkpoint during the 4-day period because all carry-on bags will be required to be searched by hand. Next story. Council approves filling diversity job. Full-time position will cost Cedar Falls $95,000 a year. This is from Andy Malone of the Courier. The city can move forward with the hiring process for a diversity, equity, and inclusion specialist now that City Council approved the job classification for the brand new position Monday night. The full-time position had been a recommendation of the Racial Equity Task Force late last year. The person who fills the job will serve as the paid expert requested by the Human Rights Commission so that it can better carry out its mission. Quote, "Hopefully, maybe we can get someone on board in 2 to 3 months," said Finance and Business Operations Director Jennifer Rodenbeck to the council. Councilors voted 6-1 on the classification. The lone dissent vote came from Dustin Ganfield. "I think we should have explored collaborative options between other entities like the community school district or the university, and that could have kept costs down and accomplished the same goals," he wrote in a text message. The position, quote, "works with all city departments to advance and embed social justice, diversity, equity, and inclusion across the organization," and, quote, "serves as a staff liaison to the Cedar Falls Human Rights Commission while providing education, outreach, advocacy, and administrative support for the promotion of human rights in the community," unquote, said the job definition. A candidate is expected to have certain required knowledge. Some of that includes an understanding of the theory, history, and practices of human rights, diversity-related issues, legislation and best practices, individual, institutional, and structural barriers to advancing equity, and adjusting policies and practices to achieve more equitable outcomes. The DEI specialist will be an employee of the Human Resources Division. A candidate is required to have a bachelor's degree and 3 years of human resource and/or human rights experience. Quote, invest in an internal staff position and external expertise to lead the development and implementation of the city's equity plan, said the task force about its recommendation in its report. Quote, provide the resources needed to support research, organizational assessments and audits, action plans, collaborations, education, evaluation and reporting, as well as the support that staff, elected officials and community members need to talk together about equitable programs, practices and policies in Cedar Falls, unquote. The council cut a new part-time human resources position that had been recommended in its fiscal year 2023 budget. Administrator Ron Gaines said at the time that it would expect to use some of the capacity in that DEI specialist position to help make up for the removal of the part-time human resources position. In the job description for the DEI specialist, the position had some 20 responsibilities and duties. One example is, quote, seeking opportunities to incorporate diversity and inclusion practices where appropriate, such as in interview training and succession planning. Another is, quote, reviewing, revising, and updating communication on city documents and the website to ensure non-discriminatory, inclusive language is used. The new position has been estimated to cost approximately $95,000 per year. And then there's a photo here, colorfully dressed young people wearing t-shirts, bright pink t-shirts, gathering. And the photo is entitled Colorful Collection. Youth art team members and visitors gather for the 4th Street Pedestrian Bridge Mural Project dedication Tuesday in Waterloo. The mural, titled Colorful Connection, consists of 1,250 feet of painted panels designed and painted by 80 artists on the youth art team. And it shows the arched bridge from the inside of the bridge, and then it shows the panels that line the sides of the pedestrian bridge. Next story. Code made more friendly to renters. Waterloo Council okays landlord rules update. This is from Maria Kuiper. The city reformed its rental housing regulations Monday to make them more renter-friendly, which brought housing advocates to the city council chambers. The council approved an ordinance amending the regulations presented for a first reading. Councilors then voted to suspend the rules to pass the second and third readings as well. The changes were approved unanimously. In the biggest change, councilors scrapped the crime-free lease addendum and replaced it with a subsection titled Defense in Equity. Previously, rental agreements had to include the crime-free lease addendum, which states that tenants could be evicted if they commit a crime. Now, city code states that tenants are given the equitable doctrine of clean hands, or the benefit of the doubt, in any action filed pursuant to Iowa Code Chapter 648. That chapter provides the legal proceedings landlords use to evict tenants. Before the change, landlords who did not add crime-free lease addendums would be in violation of city code. Under the new code, landlords who don't allow people to live in their home after committing a crime could have their landlord license revoked, suspended, denied, or declined for renewal. Michelle Jungers, that's J-U-N-G-E-R-S, a local attorney, said the changes are welcome as she's seen many evictions during her career. Quote, this isn't for all landlords. This is for bad landlords, she said. What I've seen is we have too many bad landlords. We have the highest rate of eviction in the state of Iowa. Councilor Jonathan Greider seconded this, saying the updated ordinance are not aimed at all landlords. Quote, If you are here to exploit folks, that day is done, Grider said. We're going to level the playing field for renters and landlords, not tilt the scale, but true equality for those who need it. The topic of bad landlords continued as speakers cited inadequate living conditions. Housing advocates and residents noted they've seen mold, pests, and weathered structures that affect people's well-being. Junger said she's seen residents evicted after not paying their rent when health and safety concerns are not addressed. The new code states that no rent can be legally collected if a rental is unregistered or uninspected, also known as a rent abatement. A licensing officer may order rent abated when it is determined that the owner of the rental fails to provide an essential service or fails to remedy a condition that poses a substantial risk to the health or safety of the tenant, unless the people living in the apartment caused that condition. If rent is abated, an order will be given to the owner of the address as well as the tenant by mail and by posting on the entrance door to the rental unit. If the rent abatement is canceled, that order will be given in the same way. Housing advocates echoed the concern that many rentals in Waterloo provide poor living conditions. Counselor Grider said at some houses he's toured, he would not subject the worst criminal on the face of the earth to live there. One resident, Vincent Gibbons, said one of the worst housing units he's ever seen is in an apartment by Allen College, which has signage in French and in English. Quote, signage in French means that there are a lot of Congolese and a lot of people from African countries that live there, Gibbons said. The apartment caters to immigrant communities, and they get overshadowed and funneled into some of the worst places I've ever been in. The Reverend Abraham Funchess Jr., director of the Waterloo Commission on Human Rights, affirmed that there is housing inequity in the city. He cited the 24/7 Wall Street report, which lists Waterloo as one of the worst places for black people to live, in his comments. He expressed hope that the new ordinances would enable some change. Mayor Quentin Hart said the city is going to work with a number of different partners, including landlord associations, to stop old practices. This is not just an ordinance, but it's a movement that we need to have across our entire community, Hart said. This is just beginning from work behind the scenes, so we can make Waterloo a community of opportunity for everyone. Other additions to the ordinance include a change to the definition of rent to include any service, labor, or goods given in exchange for housing. It also states that every landlord should provide renters with a tenant bill of rights summary. Cedar Falls fails to adopt resilience plan. Council rejects idea for the second time. This article from Andy Malone of the Courier. The City Council expressed Monday in a 5-2 vote that it was not ready to commit to a plan meant to build, quote, a resilient community. Several members wanted more discussion and to instead narrow the focus. Councilors Kelly Dunn and Simon Harding voted in favor, one reason being the plan would attract new businesses. Three residents spoke in support of what was referred to as, quote, a guiding document, not one that mandates following through with all the recommendations. But that was not the feeling of the majority. Quote, I think approving and adopting today could put the city on the hook for things that we're not ready to tackle just yet, said Councilmember Dustin Ganfield. It was the second time the same majority rejected the resilience plan. A few months ago, $25,000 allocated for the plan's implementation in fiscal year 2023 was pulled from the budget as part of a flurry of cuts made to reduce the tax levy hike. The resilience plan was developed over a few years by volunteers, city officials, and a consultant. It focused on three core areas: the local economy and community, weather and nature, energy and mobility. One example given by city planner Thomas Weintraut in a memo to the council was for more renewable energy options that help fuel job growth in the renewable energy sector. Another involved, quote, blue-green corridors providing recreational opportunities and attracting talent while supporting natural habitat and reducing the costs associated with traditional gray infrastructure. A third was supporting mixed-use neighborhoods that provide affordable housing options with goods and services within walking or biking distance of residences, thereby reducing reliance on automobiles. After merely receiving and filing the plan, councilors said they support its purpose. Many were present at the unveiling of the near-final draft in April. But councilors won't want to be held accountable for what's included in the lengthy technical document without fully sifting through it. Councilor Daryl Cruz compared adopting the document to, quote, the big giant ball in Indiana Jones. It can't be diverted, stopped, or changed. However, City Administrator Ron Gaines emphasized any project within the framework of the resilience plan would come back before the council for approval, before moving forward. And Mayor Rob Green noted how a lot of the guidance included in the document relates to what the city is already doing. Quote, as I've learned and worked with staff, I have seen that the adoption allows them to incorporate these options and these ideas into other plans and gives them the flexibility to know that council wants them to just look at them as options, Harding said. Without us adopting it, staff has to wait for us to go through and nitpick through it at goal setting. This is a little bit more of a proactive approach, he added. Councilor Susan DeBuer said she felt more discussion is needed with other agencies referenced in the plan. The Cedar Falls Community School District, the University of Northern Iowa, Cedar Falls Utilities, and Blackhawk County. Quote, having your vote of approval shows that you are taking this seriously, that these are things you want to work toward, said Hannah Chrisman, president of the College Hill Partnership and a planning and zoning commissioner. Council had adopted the update to the bike network plan last month with little objection. That followed a similar process, especially in its involvement of the public and city staff. In the recent past, some councilors have been criticized publicly for not respecting their time and their work. And that brings us to the halfway point of the reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier for Thursday, June 23rd, 2022. I'm Mary Frances, your reader today. And here's a reminder that you're listening to IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicapped. All material heard on IRIS is intended solely for the use of people with a print disability. If you're not a registered IRIS listener, please fill out an application on our website, which is iowaradioreading.org, or give us a call at 515-243-6833. We need to get you registered. We need to know who's listening and from where in order to keep our services free. And now it's time for obituaries. Myrna Mae Jacoby. Myrna Mae was born June 22, 1938, in Elma, the daughter of Victor and Helena Groth Larson. She was raised on a farm north of Maple Leaf, Iowa, and attended Howard No. 2 grade school. Myrna graduated from Riceville High School. She married Francis Jake Jacoby April 23, 1957, at the Maple Leaf Lutheran Church. Myrna worked at Inland Color Graphics, John Deere, and the Waterloo School Systems, retiring December of 2003. She was a member of the Trinity Lutheran Church, where she was a Sunday school teacher. She belonged to the Women's Guild and Bible Study. Myrna was chairman of the UAW 838 Recreation Committee and president of the UAW 838 Women's Committee. She enjoyed bowling, the Chicago Cubs, and the Green Bay Packers. She loved cooking and baking, especially making banana bread, her kids' and grandkids' favorite. Myrna passed away June 20, 2022, at Mercy One at the age of 83, preceded in death by her husband, her son, Edward Lee Jacoby, parents, brothers Charles, Richard, and Gordon Larson, sisters Catherine Riken and Norma Pontenberg, brothers-in-law Wayne, Richard, Daniel, and James Jacoby, and sister-in-law Kathy Hackman. She's survived by her daughters, Teresa Johnson of Waterloo and Tamara Schmidt of Princeton, Illinois, sons Todd Jacoby of Yukon, Oklahoma, and Tyrone and Vonda Jacoby of Mendon, Illinois, 13 grandchildren, 16 great-grandchildren, with two on the way, her sister Irene of Harper's Ferry, and sisters-in-law Sandy Quinn of Albert Lea, Minnesota, and Mary Jean Cartney of Byron, Minnesota. Visitation, Friday, June 24, from 5 to 8 p.m. at the Parrot and Wood at 965 Home Plaza. Funeral services, Saturday, June 25, 10:30 a.m. at Parrot and Wood. Our next obituary, Barbara Jean Wright Adams, age 91, of Waterloo, died June 18 of natural causes. Barbara was born in Waterloo August 6, 1930, the daughter of Mary Dolores Burkett Wright and Leroy Carl Wright. She graduated East High School in 1948, graduated from St. Mary's Infirmary in St. Louis, receiving her license as a registered nurse. Later in life, she received her bachelor's degree at the University of Northern Iowa in 1979. Barbara worked as a nurse at the Jewish Hospital in St. Louis, Allen Hospital, and as a school nurse for the Waterloo Schools. When working at Allen Hospital, she was head nurse of pediatrics and the nursery. Barbara was an active member of the Payne AME Church, serving in multiple capacities. She was a volunteer at Lincoln School and Allen Hospital later in life. Barbara is preceded in death by her parents, husbands Albert Adams and Lee Cherry, son Michael Adams, granddaughter Tanya Bates, and sisters Jacqueline and Marvin Ellis and Josephine Boykin. Survived by her son, Dr. Russell and Mary Adams, and brother-in-law Marvin Ellis, grandchildren, and her special niece Catherine Hughes, and nephew Jamal Brown of Chicago. She's survived by 8 great-grandchildren and 3 great-great-grandchildren. Donations should be considered to the Payne AME Church and Unity Point Health Hospice. Services will be Friday, 11 a.m. at the Payne Memorial AME Church, with a burial to follow in the Garden of Memories Cemetery. Friends may call at the church on Friday, 1 hour before the service time. And turning to the opinion page, ISU student, as tuition rises, I am homeless. And this is from Kate Keeley from the Iowa Capital Dispatch. Iowa State graduate student Rachel Sorensen said Monday she's homeless for the summer. She told members of the Iowa Board of Regents that her situation is not unique, and their plan to increase state university tuition and fees will make it even worse. Quote, my concern when I see the tuition raise or raising fees automatically goes to grad students who are struggling to get by, Sorensen said. We're having departments shut down. We're having students not be able to get funding in the summer. We're having students who are actually homeless in the summer, and they're trying to raise extra money at this point to pay their tuition if they are master's students, and then it is extremely difficult for them. Sorensen, president of the Iowa State University Graduate and Professional Student Senate, was among student leaders who spoke Monday during a special regents meeting about the effect of a proposed 4.25% increase in tuition to cover the rising costs and overall stagnant funding from the state. Sorensen said she knows international students who are stranded in the county because they are in the country because they can't afford travel expenses while paying tuition costs. Quote, I struggle to think how we can balance the need for international students to come, but at the same time raise the tuition for them to the point where they can't go back. It makes it difficult for them to go back and get their visa so that they can go back into our country, Sorensen said. University of Northern Iowa's student body president, Layla Masinovic, is a first-generation college student. She said her mother came from a war-torn country while facing the atrocities of genocide. A degree was not a possibility for Masinovic's mother, but she also always encouraged her daughter to pursue an education. Masinovic said She is serving as a voice for other students and also fighting for their future. Quote, sometimes we all understand the financial burden that a college education can cause to not only our students and their families, but to the communities that they could have served if they were able to continue their education as they have wished, she said. This unfortunate circumstance of a promising individual not being able to attend college because of rising costs will only be a great disadvantage and hindrance to our society, she said. In 2021, 56% of students graduated from a state university in Iowa with student loan debt averaging $28,500. This is roughly what out-of-state students pay in a year to attend an Iowa public university. UNI serves as the state's only regional comprehensive university, which Macinovic said is in need of greater state funding to maintain lower tuition rates in comparison with the two research universities. University of Iowa student body president Patrick Johnson said, with rising costs, the universities look toward out-of-state students to come to Iowa and stay after they graduate. Yet, as tuition increases, Iowa's median household income remains in the bottom half of the nation. Non-resident students at the University of Iowa will pay less than a 2% increase instead of an additional 4.25%. The contradiction stands boldly for all of us, Johnson said. We continue to increase economic barriers for our students and simultaneously question the reasons why they must relocate following their graduation. This model, as I'm sure we're all aware, is simply unsustainable and in need of reform. The legislature approved a 1.1% increase to all three universities. In the 2023 appropriations are still $85 million less than 2009 appropriations. Riley Post, vice president of the U of I's Graduate and Professional Student Government, said state allocations have decreased in purchasing power due to inflation, while tuition has only gone up. Quote, we're really taking the responsibility for funding these institutions away from the state and putting them on the backs of students, Post said. And now Metro Briefs. The Northeast Iowa Radio Amateur Association will participate in the National Amateur Radio Field Day exercise starting Saturday at the Hickory Hills Park at 3338 Hickory Hills Road in LaPorte City. Since 1933, ham radio operators across North America have established temporary ham radio stations in public locations during field day to showcase the science and skill of amateur radio. Members will be found at the Archer's Shelter from 1 to 9 p.m. Saturday. The event is open to the public, and all are encouraged to attend. Anyone of almost any age can become a licensed amateur radio operator. There are more than 750,000 licensed hams in the United States, and with clubs such as the Northeast Iowa Radio Amateur Association around, it's easy for anybody to get involved right here in Black Hawk County. For more information about Field Day or amateur radio, you can contact President Al Jones. And his email is prez@w0mg.net. Waverly AmVets Steak Fry on Saturday. The AmVets Post 79 will host a steak fry Saturday from 5:30 to 7 at the Waverly Area Veterans Post. That's at 1300 4th Street Northwest. Reservations and meat choices can be called in from 4 to 8 p.m. any weeknight, as well as before 2 p.m. on Saturday. Choices are sirloin, ribeye, New York strip, filet, Iowa chop, or chicken breast. And unfortunately, there's no phone number listed to call in your meat choices. I think I'd go for the New York strip. Now I'm going to go back to the front page of the Courier. Film hits the hot spots. First-time movie maker scripts tale in Waverly. This is from Melody Parker of The Courier. Saturday is National Take Your Dog to Work Day. Okay, that's weird because most people don't work on Saturday. Anyway, National Strawberry Parfait Day, National Catfish Day, and National Leon Day, which is Noel spelled backwards because it's exactly 6 months until Christmas. Joe Frenna, F-R-E-N-N-A, will be celebrating for a different reason on Saturday. He expects the day will feel like Christmas and his birthday rolled into one as he shouts action on the first day of filming his first ever movie, which is based on his original scripts entitled Hot Spots of Waverly. Quote, "I've spent the last 4 years writing the screenplay," said Frenna, who is a veteran stage actor and director familiar to Cedar Valley theater goers. Quote, "I'm in love with the script. When I read it with friends, the words jumped off the page. There are serious relationship and social issues, but it's really funny, too. It turned into a screwball comedy," unquote. He consulted with local filmmakers about the process and equipment, but, quote, "I feel like my life experience, my experience on stage as an actor and director, and being a film nut, will help me tell the story I want to tell. I'm super excited, and it's a little scary, too," unquote. Frenna has raised more than half of the $2,000 he expects to spend on the project through a GoFundMe page. He has used those funds to rent equipment, including a camera, boom mic, and other devices, but needs additional backing to hire and pay musicians to record the soundtrack. The title, Hot Spots of Waverly, is a phrase that Frenna came up with when his children were young. It's a reference to the joys of small-town life that this New York native discovered when he and his wife, Anne, moved to her Iowa hometown to raise their family 15 years ago. Quote, "For the movie, it refers to emotional hotspots, places you go where there are good and bad memories that have left emotional scars," unquote. The plot revolves around Sam, a woman with a wild streak who tends to hold on too long and too hard, and Mike, a careful man who lets go when life and relationships get hard. The unlikely pair end up on a blind date that turns into an adventure as they must confront and work through their fears that threaten to derail their date, but also their capacity to find happiness. Frenna enlisted several community theater mainstays to play roles, including Grant Tracy, Samantha Reese, and Sam Card. Filming will take place at a breakneck pace over 6 days, primarily at locations in Waverly and a few in Waterloo. Frenna said his visual style is inspired by filmmaker-actor John Cassavetes of Minnie and Mouskowitz, A Woman Under the Influence, and Faces. Cassavetes said, "The greatest location in the world is the human face, so it's not about beautiful pictures for me. It's about telling a story. I feel really alive, and I have intense confidence in this project," Frenna explained. The shoot will culminate June 30th with bar scenes at the Half Pint Saloon in Evansdale. "If anyone has ever wanted to be an extra in a movie, this is your chance. Show up. I want to pack the house. And the more people we have, the bigger the scene can be," said the director. Making the movie has become a family affair for Frenna. In addition to casting friends and colleagues in key roles, his teenage son and daughter are crew members working behind the scenes. His wife Anne is the lead vocalist in the soundtrack band Annie and the Ragtags, who also appears in the bar scenes. "Every movie needs a soundtrack, and I had to think, how do I do this without any money? So I found some songs in the public domain, about a dozen from the 1920s that still sound cool. We're revitalizing and updating those songs," he said. Three songs will be filmed on stage at the Half Pint Saloon, and the remainder will be recorded for the soundtrack. Frenna expects to complete filming by 2 a.m. July 1st, when the bar closes. "I'll start editing right away, and I'm hoping to have a rough cut by September. I'll share it with some people, see their reactions, and then make any other cuts." He plans to have a local premiere and then enter the Hot Spots of Waverly in local and regional film festivals. You can make a donation to the project at gofund.me/B1F5CF66. And switching over to sports, DNH's Harms inducted into the NHSACA Hall of Fame. Dyke New Hartford head volleyball coach Diane Harms was inducted into the National High School Athletic Coaches Association Hall of Fame Tuesday in a ceremony at Prairie Meadows in Altoona. Harms has coached 8 Wolverine volleyball teams to state titles in her career, which started in Charles City. Her 2002 Comet squad finished second in 2A. This fall, Harms will begin her 20th season at DNH, where she has compiled a 715-128 record while leading the Wolverines to back-to-back Class A titles in 20 and 2021. Quote, "It comes as no surprise that Coach Harms has been selected for induction into the National Hall of Fame," said DNH Superintendent Justin Stockdale. The quote continues, "Her commitment to our student athletes has never faltered in her 19 seasons as head volleyball coach. She deserves this recognition as an incredible coach, and we're proud to have her as a constant inspiration to our entire athletic department." All time, Harms has coached in 17 state tournaments while compiling a 980-222-40 career mark. In addition to coaching volleyball, Harms coached girls basketball for 12 years, 11 of those at Charles City, and she's coached girls track for 25 years, 11 years at Charles City and 14 at DNH. The NHSACA is the oldest coaches association in the nation. And then it shows multiple photos of Coach Harms coaching her team, whether it's volleyball. It shows her surrounded by students. It shows her holding up a clipboard and hiding a play number behind it. It just shows her basically in action in all of these coaching situations. And in prep baseball, Tigers 13 hits, too much for Dons in top 10 battle. And it shows a photo of Don Bosco Jr. Jacob Theory sliding safely into second base against New London Tuesday in Norway. Dateline Norway. The Don Bosco baseball team lost a matchup Tuesday against the New London Tigers 12-2. In a neutral site matchup between the third-ranked Tigers and the fifth-ranked Dons, the historic Norway baseball field, the setting for the 2007 film The Final Season, hosted the two Class 1A powerhouses. According to Don Bosco head coach Joel Scheres, he and New London assistant Justin Schulte set up the unique non-conference battle. Quote, "When I play in Don Bosco, Norway was in our conference," Scheres said. "It was the cool place to come play. Coach Schulte, when we talked, we knew we would both have good teams, and instead of traveling a long way, this is a good halfway point. There's nostalgia to this field," unquote. Despite both teams coming into the game red hot, 18-2 for Don Bosco, winners of their last 5, and 17-0 New London, undefeated, the Tigers jumped out to a large lead early in the contest. Doubles from Cooper Schulte and Tucker Gibber allowed the Tigers to take a 3-0 lead after 1. In the bottom of the second, New London added 6 more runs to take a commanding 9-0 lead in the top of the third. With one out and no one on, junior first baseman Mac Ortner clubbed a solo home run on the Dons' first hit of the night. Quote, "It felt good enough. I knew it definitely was not a no-doubter. I really made sure I was running hard. When I saw it go over the fence, it felt really good. I saw the launch angle, and I was like, that is probably gone, but I wanted to make sure." Trailing 9-1, Don Bosco managed to load the bases in the top of the fourth, but only earned one run on a Jack Purdy infield ground-out RBI. New London responded with one run in the bottom of the fourth to take a 10-2 lead. After a scoreless fifth inning, the Dons stranded one in the top of the sixth, before senior Ryan Ritchie plated the final 2 runs with a single to left field to walk off the Dons. Scheres said that he talked about how the Dons competed differently in the final 4 innings than they did in the first 2. We talked about those first two innings, how we just kind of gave it away, Cher said. We got to be more resilient early, but we do have fight in us, so that is something to look forward to. After falling to 18-3 with a matchup against 11-8 Colonesco up next, Cher said he hopes to see more fight and grit earlier and adjustability from his team on senior night. And that's all the time we have today for the reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier for Thursday, June 23rd, 2022. I've been your reader, Mary Frances. Here's your reminder that you're listening to IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the blind and print handicapped. You can catch recordings of these and all of our programs on our website, iowaradioreading.org. It's been my pleasure to read for you today. Have a wonderful afternoon.